Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. How does a high school valedictorian, former member of the famed 101st Airborne, respected church deacon, husband and father of three, end up with a first-degree murder conviction and serving life without parole? Deacon's Crossbow is a bone-chilling and compelling work of true crime about fate, fear, facts, and personality, especially that of convict Donald S. Graham. Donald and his wife were driving home from dance lessons when they happened upon two men on Interstate 95 in Massachusetts. When Donald reached for his crossbow, all hell broke loose. The end result, the male driver is dead and the deacon is in prison for the rest of his life. You will follow a labyrinth of events from the incident all the way to the present. The story is unique because it includes Mr. Graham's views and sentiments from within the walls of incarceration, as well as perspectives from a free man, the author. Was justice served, or was the driver the aggressor and the deacon the victim? The book that we're featuring this evening is Deacon's Crossbow, the true story of a crossbow killing on Interstate 95, with my special guest, author David G. Brown. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, David G. Brown.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you,
Dan. It's good to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. Let's talk right away with how you came to be the author of this, your relationship to this story, and how you decided the decision to be the author of Deacon's Crossbow.
Well, Dan, believe it or not, it started with a nightmare. And it started 10 years after the road rage experience occurred. And it was, I do mention this in the book. I had intended on starting the book, telling how it was a nightmare, but I opted to go directly to the scene, the incident. But I woke up in the middle of the night. We were living in California at the time. I was wearing a T-shirt while I was sleeping, and my T-shirt was all sweaty, and I had a dream of Donald Graham. And we were in the desert, and I'm walking along on the top of a mesa, and I heard someone shouting in the distance, and I came to the edge of a cliff, and there was Don holding on for dear life to a branch of a tree. And he's looking up at me, and he's yelling, "Hey, help me." And I woke up the next morning, and I shared the incident with my wife. And she said to me, "You've got to write about this. You've always loved to write. You've got yourself a heck of a story here." And lo and behold, about 3 years later, I had a book published, and that was in 2012. So that's how it came about. I guess I'd also have to include the fact that I always had a lot of admiration for Don Graham from the minute I met him. And throughout the years that we developed at first a business relationship, we developed a strong friendship. And once I had found out about this horrible incident that occurred, this road rage incident occurred, it really stuck with me. And obviously it stuck with me long enough to have a very, very bad nightmare and influence me to write the book.
Okay, now you opened the book in mid-October 2006 and we're in Providence, Rhode Island, and you're going to Shirley, Massachusetts, and you arrive at the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center, the SBCC, to visit Donald S. Graham. And you wanted to know some information. So tell us about it as you do, what he imparts to you about what happened. Because you say, what the hell happened? So you want to hear it all.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he say to you about this incident? So tell us as you do in the book.
Well, I'll do my best at that. Keep in mind, it was quite some time ago that I wrote the book, and I'm not going to read from the book. But actually, prior to that first meeting at Sousa Baranowski, we had shared several correspondence. And essentially, what I was asking Don, what could I do to help out?
Right.
And that's how it led to first 40 pages and then on and on until I had a page of close to 250 pages and the book was completed. But he gave a very, very thorough description to me as to everything happened that evening. That Sunday afternoon, and we're making reference to February 20th, 1994.
Right.
Don and his wife Sandra had traveled to Boston to go to, they took dance lessons. And they got done with their dance lessons and they were heading back to our hometown, not only Don and Sandra's, but my hometown of Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Sandra was sitting in the passenger, in the front passenger seat. She was sleeping. Don was driving on Route 95, in case people don't realize it. That's the major highway that goes from Maine all the way down to Florida. They were traveling between Boston and Providence. Don had kind of a beat-up automobile. As I recall, it was a Toyota. And he was driving. He was driving at 55 miles an hour on the inside lane. And he couldn't help but notice that there was a car traveling in the outside lane, the passing lane, that was going slower than 55, probably about 50 miles an hour, which was unusual because I would say that on an average speed in that passing lane was about 70 miles an hour.
Right.
And then he notices that this gal was also in the passing lane and almost bumped into him because he was going so slow. You could almost feel that she was very irritated. She put her bright lights on and then slipped into the middle lane, past the drivers in the passing lane to get in front of them and to continue on. At that point, the two fellows that were in the slow vehicle, they sped up and they started turning their bright lights on and off. Don spotted this. Later on, I'll probably give you a thorough description of Don's personality, but he got very concerned about this and he immediately figured that these two guys were predators because they kept almost bumping into this gal's rear fender and turning their brights on and off. So Don made a decision. I'm not going to say that this was the wisest decision in the world, but he made a decision, and he said that I'm going to teach these guys a lesson. So he pulled out of the inside lane and got into into the passing lane behind these two guys, and he put his bright lights on them. Then there were a series of unusual things that happened over the next few miles. The first thing that I could tell you was that the girl disappeared. She got off. It was no longer a part of the scenario.
Right.
Don is following these guys, and at one point they came to a complete stop. And it's almost impossible, maybe divine intervention, that he didn't crash into them, or somehow someone didn't rear-end him, because coming to such a short, a quick stop, that could have been a very likely occurrence. They started
right.
up again. At one point, these guys started throwing some things out their window at Don's car. They actually stopped a second time. They pulled a couple of other little tricks along the road that I thoroughly describe in the book. Once they got past the Route 495 intersection, they slowed down and pulled off to the side of the road. And Don, thinking that at no point would it be wise for him to get in front of these guys, in other words, to accelerate or try to just shake these guys, he decided to pull off beside them. I guess another thing that went through his mind is that had he pulled up adjacent to them, they actually might have pulled their car in and tried to sideswipe him. This was not
right.
No longer a friendly summer drive. This was turning into something that was not good at all. At any rate, now you have both cars that are pulled off the side of the road with all kinds of traffic that's coming. It wasn't exactly a roadside rest, but it was enough to get both cars well off the side to the side of the road. No sooner Don pulled up, maybe about as I recall him telling me, it was somewhere around 100 feet to 125 feet behind the other car. I might as well tell you that the driver of the car was a fellow by the name of Michael Blodgett, and the other fellow in the car was a fellow by the name of Stephen Austin, and they got out of their car, and they started walking back towards Don's car. The driver, Blodgett, was walking in the road. Don noticed that he was carrying what's called a mag or a police flashlight, one of those long black flashlights in his hand. The flashlight
right.
was on. And Aston jumped over the guardrail and started coming back at him through the woods, probably maybe with intentions of getting up behind Donald. At any rate, Sandra was now awake. She was just sitting there horrified. And Donald immediately jumped out of his car, ran to the trunk of his car, and pulled out a crossbow. Now, he was not a hunter, but he was an expert target shooter. And he locked a bolt in its place. And started telling these guys, you know, this party is over. It's time for you to go back to your car and get on with your life. And he said this a couple of times, but they were close because there was only about 100 feet of separation between the two cars. So this all happened very, very quickly. Blodgett kept advancing. And at one point, at the critical point, he was so close to Don that he raised his hand to try to knock the crossbow out of Don's hand. And I'm not 100% sure about this, and I've talked to Donald about this several times, but the way he tells it, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Blodgett's hand didn't hit the crossbow. And at that point, Don either reflexively or deliberately pressed the trigger. And that's a key point. And a bolt went off. They call the arrow a bolt. And the bolt
right.
went off. Don at first thought that it flew over Blodgett's head, but it ended up hitting him in the right shoulder, and it hit a vein. And I think rather than continue the story, I'll let you get back to other questions, but I could tell you that 5.5 hours. Michael Blodgett died. So,
well, let's go back to this 16-inch bolt. Now, you talk about an arrow and you talk about a crossbow. So, I have some questions for you before we continue on how, again, at the time, you write in the book that at the time, Blodgett with his partner, they were much bigger guys. One's 6 foot,
yes.
One's close to 6 foot, and your friend Don's about 150 pounds, but stocky. So the thing is
yes.
that these guys we're intimidating. They're advanced on the car. Sandra has woken up well before this, but she is, like you say, horrified, terrified, sitting in that car wondering what they're going to do. When he is shot in the shoulder, not everybody even realizes, even his partner doesn't realize, his friend that he's co-worker, Robert Aston, doesn't realize that he's
yes,
been shot.
Robert
he says, he says that he's been shot. He says, the motherfucker shot me. And so he
yes.
pulls out this 16-inch bolt out of his shoulder. And he's a emergency. He's an EMT worker. And so is his partner in this car. They're coming from work. So what does your friend Don do? And his wife, Sandra. Sandra's mad. You write, Sandra's mad. But what did they do? And this is important. What did they do after? What do they think has happened? How serious they think it is? And what did they do before we see what happens to Blodgett and his partner, Robert Aston, and the police?
Right. Well, before I answer that question, let me just tell you, it was not a wise move to pull that arrow out of his shoulder.
No.
That wasn't a good move. They sat in their car in total amazement. Maybe shock would be a better word to use. They were both virtually immobilized. They obviously watched Blodgett pull the arrow out of his shoulder. They watched Blodgett take that mag flashlight. By the way, when Blodgett was advancing on Donald, he was shining that flashlight right in Donald's eyes, and that's a
mm-hmm.
big flashlight with serious light. He took that mag flashlight and he destroyed the rear left light in Donald's car, at which point he then watched the two of them work their way to the front of the car and start heading back to their car. As Donald was watching, he didn't think that the injury was that fatal at the time. For all intents and purposes, eventually what happened is that he bled out. But they then went back to their car and they drove off. So either Don said to Sandra or vice versa, what do we do now? And they said, well, we've got to report this to the police. And Sandra said, look, I am sick. Let's go home and we can proceed with all the things that we have to do once we get home. And kind of the odd thing that she said to Don that remains fresh in his mind, she says, I must get home and brush my teeth. kind of a interesting reaction. But essentially, that's what they saw and that's what they did. And they did return home.
You write in the book about the reason why you said he bled out, but again, an experienced person with a crossbow with a 16-inch bolt, mm-hmm. your friend Don knew very well if something, he didn't think it was that serious, that shot. Why was that shot so serious, other than he pulled out this arrow? Is there other reasons that you've discovered for his death, which was a surprise to most people?
Well, I don't remember the exact name of the artery that's located in the shoulder. I know I wrote about, I specified it in the book, but being, both of these guys were EMTs, by the way. There's the Sturdy Memorial Hospital is probably somewhere in the vicinity of 10 miles away from where the incident occurred. So they made a beeline for the Sturdy Memorial Hospital. At which point, let's put it this way. We could have described Sturdy Memorial as a five-star hospital. It's a real small hospital located in Attleboro, Massachusetts. And when they got there, there's a lot of questions as to whether the doctors that took care of Blodgett did the right things. And I go into that in detail. I even made a point of doing some research with one of the top surgeons in Rhode Island who I knew quite well to get his opinion about it. And essentially what he said to me is that based on the amount of blood that Blodgett had lost, had he lived, for all intents and purposes, he would have been a vegetable. And the last thing that I could tell you is that after Blodgett had been at Sturdy Memorial for several hours, he was then helicoptered out to Mass General, which is a five-star hospital, to the Worcester, Massachusetts branch, and that's where he passed away.
Right. Now, meanwhile, while Don and Sandra are contemplating their next move, police come to their door. What is Don and Sandra's reaction, and what do the police do? And this is important in terms of what do they have in terms of warrants, and how do they proceed? Tell us about that.
Well, in a million years, never did they expect that the police would show up at their door less than 10 minutes after they arrived at home. Aston apparently had gotten part of Donald's driver's license, his license plate number, and with that information, they tracked down, they very, very quickly, obviously, tracked down Donald's address, and so there were two Woonsocket police, members of the Woonsocket police force that showed up at his door. As a matter of fact, Don said to them, I'm assuming that you're here because of the incident on Route 95. And they were a little bit surprised to hear that, but they said yes. Don told him his side of the story while they were standing outside of the house. And by that time, Don had already taken the crossbow and brought it down into his basement and put it with several other firearms and weapons that Don had. And he said to the police, he says, "Would you like to see the weapon?" And they said, "Yes." So Don turned around, started walking into his house. Little did he know at that moment that they were standing behind them with guns drawn. And they followed Don into the house without a warrant, I might add. Mm-hmm. From there on in, Don's two kids were upstairs watching television. They came down. There was one of the private detectives from the Woonsocket Force that showed up, a fellow by the name of Marzini, and they questioned Don and Sandra, and they then arrested both of them and brought them down to the Woonsocket Police Department. And also while they were there, Massachusetts State Police showed up and they took a report of the incident also.
Did Don and Sandra say, listen, we're not going to be answering any questions, we opt to talk to an attorney first? What did they do in that regard, and what was the result of their decision?
They, at the time, didn't feel like they were guilty of anything. As far as Don was concerned, his action was an action of self-defense. I kind of put the whole incident into three acts. Act one being the drive, act two being the road rage incident, and act three being the aftermath. So this would be the beginning of the aftermath, and they were very straightforward and honest with every and any question that both the local police and the Massachusetts State Police asked. At that time there was no attorney discussion at all. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen for several days after the incident.
Well, that's the point. They made statements. They both made statements, and then they were charged, both of them. He charged with more serious charges, obviously, and including first degree murder, which in Massachusetts would net you life without the possibility of parole. She is charged for accessory after the fact, and soon
Correct.
After is released on a recognizance, but then there's an issue of bail. Does Donald get bail? And then right away you include really the incredible articles that occur in the media.
Yes.
And right away, yeah, DA Prosecutor Letourneau comes forward, and we've just heard the depiction from Don and from your investigation. This DA Letourneau in the article presents a much different perspective about what happened that day in February, doesn't he?
Yeah. He really did not describe Donald in very complimentary terms. On the contrary, he almost described Donald as a ruthless, heartless criminal that was just aching to use that crossbow at some time in his life. And that is just so untrue.
Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just share this with you. I became friends with Don Graham the first day I met him. I just had such interesting conversation with him. I found him to be so fascinating. He's a Canadian citizen, number one. As a matter of fact, to this day, he still has maintained his Canadian citizenship. But he was also a member of the United States 101st Airborne Division, which is one of the more famed divisions in all of American military. He's a brilliant man. He was valedictorian of his class, extremely well-read, terrific sportsman, by the way. Of course, being from Canada, hockey is his first love, but he just loves sports. Very, he's kind of quiet, low-key, dry wit, but extremely straightforward. You know, he just calls a spade a spade. You know, that type of a person. And maybe a little bit too straightforward to suit his own good, But that's his nature, and I admire that. And I always found him to be as honest as the day is long. And lastly, he was deacon of his church, which kind of made it relatively easy for me to draw the conclusion that the title of the book should be Deacon's Crossbow. Kind of has a twist in the name of it. But he was so good in that position that he helped form the very first soup kitchen for the poor in the city of Woonsocket, which was domiciled in the basement of the Woonsocket First Baptist Church. So I hope that gives you a good description as to what my friend was like. Hardly the description of the personality that Letourneau created.
But D.A. Letourneau has to put a narrative that will aid in the prosecution. So other than, you know, giving a sense
right.
that he's a bad character, bringing up his driving record of impaired driving in Rhode Island, tried to equate that with criminality in general, and that this guy was a guardian of the highway and had a crossbow ready to use it, and depicted some of the
mm-hmm.
things that you have said in terms of not advancing, basically saying, well, sure, they advanced on the car, but Donald Graham had every opportunity to leave, which is conflicts with what Donald has said and your investigation.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dan, I'm the kind of person that pretty much I've got to see it to believe it. All right. Part two is when I tell you that I have always found Donald Graham just to be the most honest person. I just have always felt whatever Donald said is the way it happened. But I have to leave a little bit of a percentage out there that maybe the way he tells the story might not be 100%. I think that particularly with all of the interviews that you do, where you're dealing in similar type issues, when you're in a critical traumatic state of mind, traumatized, it makes sense that you don't remember whether the bolt accidentally went off, or whether he pressed that trigger on purpose. He doesn't remember. That's why I earlier suggested that I kind of believe that Blodgett hit that crossbow, and that's what triggered the arrow going off, the bolt going off.
Let me
Can
ask
I do a
this
good job?
Question.
Yeah.
Let me ask
yeah.
this question. Did you ask,
sure.
and I think the audience is asking too, okay, he uses the crossbow for target practice, as you write. He doesn't use it for hunting. But
correct.
Why? And you do tell in the book, why? Would he have a crossbow? And I think this is important. It didn't come
mm-hmm.
up in a trouble. I think this is important. Why would he have a crossbow in his trunk? What for? What in case of what? In New England?
Good question. That's a good question. As I recall, Don had said to me that he always had concern that maybe something really bad might happen. And maybe it was prophetic because something bad did happen. He had also indicated to me that there were a lot of raccoons. Now, this might sound a little bit odd, but you know, they're rodents. You can get rabies from raccoons. And that there had been some in his neighborhood and in his yard, so that he had that crossbow in there. But I think it was primarily because, just as a defense mechanism, a defense tool, a firearm, that's not a crime. Maybe you and I wouldn't do that. and maybe the majority of people wouldn't do that, but he did. He did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's reasonable
to
think. I think it's reasonable for the first part of that answer in terms of he recognized this as a viable weapon that he was quite good at. He was, expert, but he was quite adept at using this crossbow. And so I don't know if that makes a huge difference, but I thought at least that question would come up, especially when given this Letourneau, the DA's prosecution, and how he depicts not only Donald, but the turn of events that led to this fatality. We're going to use this as an opportunity, David, for just to talk for a second about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. The FabFitFun Fall Box is on sale now. These boxes sell out fast, so sign up for yours today. The Fall Box is a great way to treat yourself or someone you love with FabFitFun's fabulous box of products. Every box is customized to your unique taste and interests. I remember the first time my wife Lisa opened up her first FabFitFun box. She was excited just about the idea and then thrilled at discovering inside all the unique, amazing products. In just recently, 2019 Fall Box, Lisa especially liked the Twine brand gourmet wood and ceramic cheese board gift set. Beautiful, she said. A nice 2-in-1 salt and pepper grinder from Epair, and from Avita, daily hair repair. Lisa's already excited to get and anticipation of getting her next FabFitFun box. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box filled with full-size beauty, fitness, and lifestyle products. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, David, we might as well get to the trial, because we have a long way to go in explaining this twisting and turning story. And you put not the blame, but some of the reasons for things turning out the way they were, not only in, as you describe later on in the book, the choices that Donald made that night, that fateful night, but also his decisions in terms of statements he made. And we talk about him taking the witness stand, Sandra being on the witness stand testifying. Tell us, you weren't at the trial, but you described the events in the book just as if you were there. Tell us what happens in this incredible trial. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I can't be like 100% correct in all of my answers here, Dan, simply because I wrote the book from 2009 to 2012. So it's several years ago. And during that time, I've also been writing, I published another book, and I'm in the process of a third book coming out. So all of that is not 100% clear. The first thing that I want to tell you is that I thought it would really be a good idea to cover the trial primarily through newspaper articles from the newspapers in the area, mostly our local newspaper, the Woonsocket Call and the Providence Journal. As far as some of the specifics of the trial are concerned, I believe that virtually everything that Donald said during the trial was totally honest. And he created for himself and kind of took charge of his attorneys and kind of dictated the terms as to how he wanted the trial to go, which is very unusual. And maybe not the wisest thing in the world, but this is Donald's personality. As I said, he's a straight ahead kind of guy, and he felt that self-defense was the way to go. I know that his attorneys had suggested that maybe he could have pleaded a temporary insanity plea, which could very well be possible. In Donald's testimony, he was very straightforward and very aggressive. And throughout the trial, Letourneau just kept building a monster. And there's another underlying feature to the case. Michael Blodgett's family, his father, if I'm not mistaken, was head of the civil defense program, either in Massachusetts or in the Attleboro area. And his brother was a local policeman. And I mention that because so many of us, as the trial was taking place, we felt that Don was kind of being railroaded. Going back to the scene of the crime, it was never cordoned off. There was never anything brought up from the prosecution that they found glass on the road from where Blodgett had broken the light. When they had Aston testify, he said that at no time did Donald give them any warning, whereas Don said on two distinct moments, he did tell them to stop and go back. Aston totally denied that as being true. So it's a little bit difficult for me, Dan, to recreate all those moments that I wrote about in the book. I will defend myself on that comment by saying, if you read the book, you could see that I dotted all my I's and I crossed all my T's in covering it. So if you wanted to ask a couple of more specific questions related to the trial, probably I can remember how I reacted to it all as it was taking place.
Well, needless to say, it's interesting, too, when you're faced with Donald taking the stand, but he's not, for various reasons, a sympathetic figure. There are statements originally that he made where he's asked if he's sorry, and he says, so he doesn't have that remorseful, emphatic persona that he can present at trial. But also,
exactly.
his wife Sandra is really of no value because she didn't really witness anything. So the testimony that's real valuable is this Robert Aston. And they're co-workers, not necessarily friends, as you try to investigate. But that testimony was very strong. And the prosecutor's case, in theory, was pretty strong and presented pretty well at this trial. Don's defense, again, Don is somewhat combative or trying controlling with his attorneys, David Cooper and Scott Lutz, but they failed at basically defending the idea that it was self-defense because Don makes some honest statements, again, very honest statements, not very calculating as a criminal, so I understand what you're saying. He just said, well, I'm not sure if it was intentional or if it was an accidental. You know, he makes statements like that didn't help him. Didn't help him at trial, didn't help him before. What is the result of this trial?
I agree with that, Dan. I think that it would have been wise for Lutz and Cooper to have brought some character witnesses, people that could make statements about Don so that the jury would get a softer sense of this man's character. That never took place. There's a number of things that I question in the book of issues that Don's attorneys did not bring up.
Right.
So,
well,
so
the thing
I would
is,
have to agree with you. Go ahead.
Now, the idea is that Don has his day, and you talk about an interesting national media attention. Tell us when Dan Rather and CBS 2020 comes into the picture and what Don's hopes are with this interview, and then tell us what happens in that interview, basically.
Well, the event took on some national consequences. It's like Don became like the poster boy for road rage.
Right.
Not exactly the most enviable position to hold, reputation to have. But Dan Rather, yes, he did a program. The 24 Hours, I think that was the name of the show. I know I devote a chapter to that. but he did a really good job of earning Donald's trust in the interviews that he conducted prior to the television program. And Don felt that Rather could possibly be helpful in setting him free, as opposed to the life without parole sentencing. As it turns out, the program was really centered on road rage. Not only Donald's case, but several other cases at the around 1994, when the incident took place. So the program was pretty much designed to encourage people to take it easy. We all experience moments of road rage, but don't let what happened to Donald Graham happen to you. So I wasn't exactly overwhelmed or satisfied with the program. And as it turned out, it was not helpful for Donald's cause.
And Donald was very angry at the portrayal overall. Disappointed, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. He did not. Let's put it this way: he could have made a better witness, but this is his style. This is his way, and he felt that in no way, shape, or form should he have been charged with first degree or life without. And from that standpoint, Dan, I fully agree with him.
Sure, certainly.
When I think of so many other cases that I've read about, or movies that I've seen, that some of these, like Hansen, Manson, some of these cases, I mean, these people deserve first degree life without parole. Donald Graham, I think, should have been manslaughter two. Manslaughter two, I think, would have been the correct sentence.
Well, let's talk about what he does post-conviction. You get involved 10 years after the
mm-hmm.
trial, and so your
yes.
goal is to help out as much as you can. You put a team together of people. Reverend Francis,
yes.
Vic Blank, you put a team of people
yes.
that have different skills, and you want to have the same goal, try to get to the issues. You find out all the facts. You've got all the information. Now you're trying to re-interview people. You're trying to get to people
mm-hmm.
to see what they might know that will help you build a case. Tell us, in what you do, who do you have to approach, and what is the approach in terms of retrial, approaching a governor? What is it exactly you do?
Right. Well, step number one is that we interviewed a couple of different lawyers. We came up with a fellow by the name of Tom Dickinson, who was a prosecutor. As a matter of fact, he worked for a number of the Rhode Island attorney generals. And after talking with Tom on several occasions, we then reported back, Vic and I reported back to Don and suggesting that we thought it would be a good idea to hire Tom. Now, what I could tell you, in Massachusetts, you get two opportunities to appeal. And by the time we brought Tom Dickinson in, Donald had already exercised his second appeal and had been turned down. So one of the things that Dickinson shared with us, he says, you know, he said, because of that, our chances are not very good. We kind of came to the conclusion that the only way that his case could be brought up again for trial is there would have to be what's referred to as new news, N-E-W-S, something extraordinary related to the case that warranted reopening the case and having a new trial. I believe that Tom did the best he could to try to find something to that extent. I write thoroughly about the variety of things that Tom did do, to no avail, I might add. But one of the other things was to see if we couldn't pursue a pardon from the governor or the possibility of Don being transferred to Canada. And in my very last conversation with Don, he told me that is still a possibility. And I believe that if that were to happen, there's a good chance that he'd become a free man, because the maximum sentence for any crime in Canada is 15 years. I hope that helps.
Sure. The thing is very interesting, too, is all through this, you know, you do include the incarceration of your friend, you know, a deacon.
Yes.
Now in prison with killers, this person that has to make his way. Sandra has to divorce him because of civil suit actions, so that's understandable. So he says alcoholism, you know, his marriage survived the alcoholism, but his marriage survived the alcoholism, but they ended up divorced anyway out of this.
Yes,
didn't they?
Yes. Sandra would have lost her home because the Blodgett family brought a suit against Donald, a civil suit.
Don's personality prevails with this as well, and he knows this case better than anyone, he believes. And so through you and through Vic, he is talking to Dickinson and any attorney after this as well, because there are more attorneys after this, in that
he thinks that
there's two key issues, and he thinks the most important issue is that the misconduct by Judge McHugh, denying his constitutional right to an open public trial, in that they did close chambers in the first day of this trial. So Tom Dickinson would disagree with that in terms of the best idea to move forward, or the best motion to move forward with and have the best success with potentially. He thought that it would be better to look at this in terms of ineffective counsel. Tom was very adamant about that. Now, regardless of what Don wanted, they did try to do this the way Tom Dickinson had envisioned, and like you say, it didn't work out, did it?
No, correct. You've done your homework very well, Dan, because I'm really happy that you brought up the fact about ineffective counsel. Interestingly enough, there are two other lawyers that I had thoroughly discussed the case with, and they also felt that that would have been the better move of any possible move to see if he could have gotten a retrial. Never came
right.
to be. Never came to be.
It's fascinating in the book, too. You take the reader through the journey of the close calls, the twists and turns, the doors that have to be, you know, basically broken down. But then there is so much hope and optimism, even from people that are veterans in the legal community like Dickinson, to say, you know, I think we can do this. There's odds, but I still think, essentially, but unfortunately, there is no happy ending in this. You say that even the Canadian angle that he would be able to be transferred to a Canadian prison, that's not as easy as it sounds, is it?
Exactly. No, you're exactly right about that. And as far as maybe getting different counsel at the time or 10 years later when I started writing my book, you got to pay a lot of money for these big-time lawyers, big mm-hmm. bucks. And that wasn't exactly Donald's situation. So unless he could find a top-notch lawyer that was game to participate pro bono, he wasn't going to get one of the country's top lawyers to defend him. And I think that you struck on a good point there, because possibly if he did have that type of a lawyer, he'd be a free man today.
Mm-hmm.
So...
The thing is it's hard to unwind convictions. It's much harder.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's easy to say you should have done this. You should have been a better witness. Sandra could have been more prepared. The defense,
absolutely.
Like if it was ineffective, but who knows how limited they were in terms of experience, in terms of the judge's assistance as well. Again, you know, Don talks about Tom Dickinson first I thought it was just typical revenge at the judge that sentenced me, but he did have a different vision or version of events once he saw a report from your friend the associate, the Skolron report, which outlined everything early on.
Yes.
Very, very interesting how important that report was through all of this.
John Skolron did an amazing job at detailing all of the flaws and the errors related to the trial, and you're right. Because of that, I was encouraged. I had a lot of drive and a lot of impetus, and thinking that we're going to win this thing. And you know, most people when they're reading a book, Dan, they prefer that it be a comedic ending, a comedy, as opposed to a tragic ending. And I thought about that, that as far as this book being extremely attractive to the public, well, maybe it won't be because it is this difficult ending, and then. I received an email from a lady from the Netherlands that had read the book, and she said something in her email to me that really struck home to me and was a bit comforting to me. And she said, "Your book is a book of conscience." And I never even thought of it that way as I was writing the book, or even after, until I heard that comment. And I think she's right, because I think as you read the book, you can't help but put yourself in the shoes of the players. Obviously, the two major players being Michael Blodgett and Donald Graham. There's one other thing that's really very unusual here is that, I'm not happy with what Donald did. I wish he just kept driving, and had he had a cell phone back in 1994, he could have called the police and says, "Hey, there's a nutbag out on the road. You probably want to get out here if you can as quickly as possible, to see it." It wasn't meant to be, and here we are with a book of conscience, with what I think is an absolutely fascinating story, and one I'm going to have a very, very difficult time ever forgetting. You know, it's going to haunt me for the rest of my life.
It's interesting, too, in the discovery as you lead the reader through this, because obviously now we know what this outcome is, but along the way you have this optimism that this book will make a difference, that this team will make a difference, that these lawyers, attorneys that you had to, it was hard to find, that these people, once you convinced them, and you hounded these people, Don was adamant, and you were, I think, even more, and Vic Blank and Reverend Francis. It's an interesting team, all with the same goal, very honorable goal. But there's so many close calls. There's so many. You tried to contact Robert Aston. You thought there had to be some other, maybe, just possibly. So there's so many things that you keep the reader on the edge of their seat, thinking that, yes, he's close, that this makes sense, that this man certainly made a mistake but doesn't deserve life without parole, and certainly there has to be one valid way after all this time that this can happen, and yet not.
Yep.
But it was incredible journey, very honorable ambition.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much, David G. Brown, for coming on and talking about Deacon's Crossbow, the true story of a crossbow killing on Interstate 95. Is there a website or a Facebook page for Deacon's Crossbow?
Yes, there is. Before I give you that, Dan Zupansky, I want to thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I possibly could have been a little bit better, a better interview if we were a little bit closer to the time. And I think, I hope you can understand that it's difficult to remember all of the details. But trust me, they are in the book. The book can easily be purchased on Amazon just by going to Amazon. I've also got a website. It's Brave Down Books, BRAVEDOWN books.com. That's all one word. And if folks so desire, you can go to that website. You can read an excerpt, and you can also read an excerpt from the more recent book that I just wrote, called Shadowing Dizzy Gillespie. And on Facebook, there's a Deacon's Crossbow page. We've got a couple of hundred folks that follow it. I'd be delighted for people to check it out, get on board. Periodically, I put some information in there. It's amazing, Dan, to think that this event happened 25 years ago.
Incredible.
So, you know, is there a chance that he can get out? Sure, there's a chance that he can get out. Whether the odds are in his favor, well, maybe they're not. But it is what it is, and for me, it will always be an amazing, haunting experience. And I hope that people feel that I did a good job of writing the book.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much. You've been a great friend to Don, and you wrote an exemplary book here. Thank you very much about Deacon's Crossbow, the true story of a crossbow killing on Interstate 95. Thank you very much, David G. Brown. Have a great night. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. You too.
Good night.
Good night.